quick introduction to today's episode with my guest, dietitian Orla Walsh, on all things weight loss, gut health, IBS, and everything to do with food and nutrition, really. I absolutely love this. I've been keeping a theme for the first few episodes of January as much as I can with Scott Bapty, with Rupi from Doctor's Kitchen, and now with Orla, keeping a big focus on nutrition, diet, and health in general. And today's episode is, I love it. Absolutely love it. I love Orla's stuff. We met at the Wellfest in Galway. We were both speaking on the stage around the same time, and I was talking about the Marathon de Saab, and she was speaking about nutrition and diet tips for fat loss, for weight loss, etc. And we were chatting, and I was like, oh, she's got a great way of putting messages across. And I started following her social, and I can't recommend following her stuff enough. It's very evidence-based, very science-backed. The only thing with today's episode, for some strange reason, sometimes when I speak after Orla, Orla speaks after me, there's a little bit of a, for some strange reason, I have no idea why it does it. It doesn't do it all the time, but it does it like three or four times during the episode for some really strange reason. So I don't know if it was down to a connection thing or what happened, but it does that. So just be aware of that sound, but hopefully it doesn't affect the experience of the episode, because I can't recommend this one enough. I think if you are interested in nutrition, in diet, in health, and if you're listening to this podcast, there's very high possibility that you are, you're going to love this episode. Orla's, as she says herself, a science geek, but she's also a science geek that is very relatable in her ability to see it from both sides, and she's not very dogmatic on her ideas, and she can argue opposite sides of things equally well, which is one of the reasons why I love her, because you can decide then, well, what's most applicable to you. So some of the things we talked about, I won't spend too long on this, was weight loss myths, gut health, the importance of gut health, how good or bad gluten really is, autoimmune issues, IBS, PCOS, thyroid issues, testosterone and alcohol for men was another one we covered towards the end of the episode. So in my new book, GEA Leaner, Stronger, Faster, I actually have a section on this that me and Orla talked about at the end, and it's something I'll probably be talking about more going forward, because there's a lot of good content out there for estrogen for females and for women and its effects, you know, positively, negatively, depending on the balance. But there's not an awful lot for guys on testosterone, and particularly testosterone and alcohol in particular. So if you've read GEA Leaner, Stronger, Faster, or you've ordered a copy, you've probably seen that section already. And I speak about the food and the supplements to help boost that naturally, and some of the lifestyle changes to make sure that you're maximizing testosterone. But we talked about that at the end of today's episode as well. So I'm going to get straight into it. Absolutely love this one. Orla, qualified as a dietitian from King's College London, is one of my go-to people when I have any nutrition queries or questions. So I hope you enjoy today's episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. Today's guest, Orla Walsh. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm so excited to introduce today's guest, Orla Walsh. It's Welsh down here, but I'm pretty sure you say Walsh, Orla, am I right?
yeah, Walsh.
I love it. Orla qualified as a dietitian from King's College London. She initially obtained an honours degree in physiology from Trinity College, allowing her to apply her detailed knowledge of the human body to the nutritional management of conditions and diseases. Since then, Orla upgraded her BA in physiology to an MA in physiology and went on to achieve a master's in clinical nutrition at Roehampton University in London. Orla's areas of expertise include weight loss, irritable bowel syndrome, disordered eating, and heart health. Additionally, she is passionate about nutrition and its impact on fertility. She regularly writes for national newspapers, appears on television, and is a guest speaker on radio stations on these topics. Orla has a personal interest in sport, which naturally led onto a professional involvement in sports nutrition. She obtained a postgraduate diploma in sports and exercise nutrition at the University of Ulster and was involved in the nutritional management of many athletes leading up to the 2016 Olympics in Rio. Orla currently holds a clinic in the Dublin Nutrition Centre, Dublin 2, as well as within Premier Physiotherapy in Dublin 16. She also writes a weekly article for the Irish Independent newspaper. I'm so excited to dive into all things food, nutrition and diet in today's episode. Firstly, Orla, you're due in March, so congratulations. That's freaking awesome. And secondly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah, the pregnancy, it's harder to create a human than I thought. So huge respect to any mums out there. It's much harder than I ever thought it would be, but it's really special. I'm excited and nervous.
We were just saying literally right before we went on air, you struggled a little bit in the beginning, more so than now. Was it your first few weeks that were the struggle?
Oh, no, I was first 16 or so weeks. So there was a good 4 months there, but I was quite sick. So you're nauseous all the time. So people, it's similar sort of nausea if you've ever had a hangover. And you have this food aversion. So you go off weird things that you normally love. So it's a weird time, but I'm feeling better now than I did at the start, certainly.
I love it. I talked a little bit on your background, and as I said just before we went on air, anytime anyone asks me about nutrition and diet stuff, I'm like, go check out Orla's page. I was like, her stuff's so accessible, particularly the Instagram. But tell everybody, anything I left out in the description, tell everyone a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, no, I think you covered everything. So you can tell I'm a total geek, and I've spent far too much time in college doing postgrads and things. I'm probably still not done. I'm just a scientist through and through. And I suppose I've always had an interest in nutrition and the impact of nutrition on the human body from a very young age. And I've grown up in a fairly fit family, you know, so we're not fitness fanatics as people would know them today, but like my dad would be an adventurer. So, you know, he was a mountaineer for years. And like I used to grow up with my dad going off to the Alps. And now more regularly, he kind of goes to the likes of Greenland and he's around Cape Horn, and you can't call him, you know, for 3 months at a time. And, you know, so I come from a fit family and we always grew our own veg. So I suppose I just followed my heart and followed my head, and I just loved science. So it was a natural progression into the job I'm in, I guess.
Yeah, that comes across. And even when we met at the Wellfest event in Galway, you can clearly see that you're somebody that is, as you said, a science geek, but you love it in terms of the nutrition and the effect that it has on people's, you know, sleep is something you talked about on that particular day. And yeah. I know you cover a lot with weight loss and irritable bowel. I want to stay on that just for a second, because weight loss and irritable bowel syndrome are kind of two major focuses for you, and you put out a lot of valuable content on both. So I'll start with weight loss. What problems, struggles, or misconceptions do you tend to see with people when you're working with them when it comes to weight loss?
Well, I suppose there's a lot of food fads out there. You know yourself that there's a lot of people who aren't qualified to give advice, who are giving advice out there, and they're driving these myths and these confusions around nutrition. So often people think that weight loss is all about eating as little as possible, being hungry, maybe cutting out some of their favorite foods. Often people think that weight loss is about low something or high something, rather than a moderate amount of everything. So I think there's a lot of myths around weight loss. So people tend to come to me and they've tried several things before in the past. And again, I think people are often trying to find a quick fix for something that was a problem that took a long time to rear its ugly head. So there's no quick fix with weight loss. So I think when it comes to weight loss, it's just very confusing for people out there. And I guess I try to dispel myths and try and make it as easy as possible, and I'm quite blunt on my Instagram, and I don't sit on the fence because I think fence sitting doesn't help as well, you know. So I just try and get the research out there and make it easy and understandable.
I'm curious, when I think weight loss and fit loss, I kind of think pyramid of prioritization, in terms of there's one or two things that are more important than the others. But generally for me, I normally go calories first and then build from that. What's kind of your foundation of pyramid of prioritization? What's the foundation principle for weight loss that, you know, there's loads of different nitty gritty micro bits we can get into, but what's your kind of foundation pillar for weight loss? What approach do you generally take with people?
Oh, it always depends, because you see, when I go into a consultation with someone, I look at anthropometric stuff. So, you know, weight and body fat percentage and maybe waist circumference and that sort of stuff. I look at bloods, biochemistry, I look at medical history, family history, and I look at everything else in their life that's important to consider as well. And the approach is always different, and I find that it's always different for every person. And for some people, you just need to hit the big problems first, because the big problems, when you solve them, you know, they make the biggest difference. And then you work on all the little issues as you go along. And you see, when it comes to weight loss, people get overweight by doing a whole host of things less healthily. And unless you address all of those things, they're just going to lose weight and then put it back on again. You're right in your approach that, you know, calories are probably the most important thing. And then you kind of, once you consider energy in, energy out, it's also worth noting where the calories are coming from. The typical things that I see that people, mistakes that people make time and time again, is they have this little piddly breakfast and it's low in protein, low in fiber. And they spend the rest of the day chasing hunger and they eat most of their calories after 5 o'clock. And that's the something that I see with Irish people and their diets time and time and time again. So I suppose I usually fix the balance at each meal and even try and make each meal of equal size and equal importance. So I'd say that's my number one priority for most people.
Yeah, and I love what you said there, that you look at it from a holistic, nearly a holistic point of view, because as you said, if you don't understand someone's, you know, physiology or what's going on in their life or all these different things, it's nearly impossible to give any recommendation off the back of that. You mentioned fad diets there. I'm just curious, because you don't sit on the fence, which is something that I love about you. Is there any particular thing that comes to mind in the quote unquote health or fitness industry or fad diet that particularly irks or annoys you?
Well, I think it's because, you see, like yourself, I look at it from a holistic point of view. And the reason why I do that is because everyone is an individual. So one diet does not fit all. So what you see on social media is that someone has tried one thing. So they've tried being a vegan, or they've tried a ketogenic diet, and it's really worked for them. They feel great. They're healthier than they've ever been. But they now think that everyone, in order to feel as good as they feel, has to do exactly what they did. And they feel that everyone, the whole world, should follow what they are doing. And it's nearly like a cult following, rather than actually going, okay, we're all individuals. We all have individual physiologies, body types, lifestyles, everything, even personalities and tastes. It's nearly this forgetting that you actually have to tailor it to that person. And a ketogenic diet might be great for one person and horrific for another. A vegan diet might be good for one person and horrific for another. So my problem is, my biggest bugbear would be that this assumption that it's one diet fits all, and that general advice is something that everyone should follow. And it's not, it just really isn't.
Yeah, it's one of the, when I talk nutrition anytime on the podcast or on anytime I do talks or events, I'm like, if there was one diet that worked, everybody would follow that diet and they'd look the way they wanted to look and feel the way they wanted to feel. I was like, it's about testing and trialing things. Because the keto diet, that's the one that has a little bit of a trigger for me, because I'm actually a huge fan of the keto diet coming from an endurance background. But for like general weight loss, I'm not, again, it depends. As you said, it's brilliant for some people, but the over restriction of it is something that can make it quite hard to adhere to. And at the end of the day, if you're not sticking to any diet, it doesn't matter what diet you're on. If you can't stick to it, you're not going to get any results from it. When it comes to weight loss, you obviously tailor it based on each person, but for anyone that's listening here and weight loss or fat loss is their goal, is there one, two, or three tips that come to mind that you're like, right, focus on this? We spoke about get your meals down to a portion size. Is there anything else that comes to mind in terms of, you know, you mentioned sleep the day we were in Galway doing the Wellfest event. Is there any other tips and tricks that come to mind that people may not think of when it comes to weight loss or fat loss?
Yeah, I think it's go back to basics. That's what I'd say to everyone listening. And you see, sometimes the best advice is the most boring. So for example, you know, people go, yeah, when I encourage them to drink more water. And I think it's because it sounds like such boring advice, but because it's boring, people are like, it couldn't make that much of a difference. But it does. Because if someone is better hydrated, they have better energy. If you have better energy, you have better motivation. Motivation to exercise more and move your body more, and motivation to actually eat well. So it's one of those fundamental things. And then there's cool little studies. Like there was one where they got a group of overweight and obese people, and they got them to drink a pint of water 30 minutes before breakfast, lunch and dinner. And they started losing a pound a week, and they didn't do anything else. They just did that. So I think sometimes the most boring advice is the best. The other thing is that, like, people are sick of hearing it, you know, the five a day. But, you know, people should eat more fruits and vegetables. And the more fruit and veg you put into your diet now and keep it up, the leaner you will be in 3 to 5 years time. And that's just a no-brainer. And that has been studied time and time again. In fact, they can even bring it down to portions and saying, you know, if you have an extra vegetable, what at like every single day, what will that look like in terms of your weight in 3 to 5 years? They've done that, and they've shown that it, like, both fruit and vegetables, an extra piece every single day will mean that you're leaner in 3 to 5 years. So if you have one piece, you'll get some results. If you have two, you get another. Three, you get another. So what I encourage people to go is, okay, well, taking this advice, as boring as it may be, I'm going to actually just make sure that breakfast, lunch and dinner contain at least two portions of fruit or veg. And as simple and as boring as that may sound, it is incredibly effective, especially, and of course, especially if you keep it up. And in 3 to 5 years, you will be lighter and leaner.
Yeah, the compound effect starts to kick in then. And what, you know, one of the things I'll say on the podcast is, tell me what you do every day and I'll tell you where you'll be in a year. Like, tell me how you eat, tell me how you eat every day, I'll tell you how you'll feel in a year or 5 years. You mentioned the first time we met about the you used to get in-season fruits and vegetables shipped to your house. Do you still do that?
Oh, I did. The company closed down, so I had to find a new one. I was gutted because it was brilliant. You see, I think variety is really important, because I think we're all suckers that if we actually were to look at our shopping list, there's probably 15 items on it on repeat, and we buy the same 15 items over and over again. And even in terms of just, say, gut health, which is obviously a very popular topic for many reasons, but in order to optimize your gut health and optimize your gut bacteria, we need to be eating 30 different plants a week. And that might sound like a lot for people, but it's surprisingly easy to achieve. It just means buying different fruit or veg every 2 to 3 days. And it just means eating a variety of nuts or seeds, not just focusing on peanuts or almonds or cashews or whatever you like the most. And it's about mixing up your grains and your whole grains. So it's kind of going, okay, well, if I had oats for breakfast, I might do quinoa in my salad at lunch. And then I might do buckwheat or, potato or sweet potato for my dinner. So if you mix up your grains, you mix up your fruit and veg every 2 to 3 days, and you mix up your nuts and seeds, you will actually hit that 30 different fruits and veg a week. Yeah, it's the whole getting it bought to your house is a brilliant thing for many reasons. Firstly, I grow my own fruit and veg. I don't have any plants in my garden that aren't edible. And but, you know, that kind of the summer I get most of the benefit of that. But eating locally couldn't be any more important. It's really important for the environment, but it's really important for the nutritional condition of your fruit and veg. I think people focus in too much on any one area, such as organic versus not organic. But actually, one of the things that impacts the nutrition of our fruit and veg more than anything else has to be whether or not you eat local fruit and veg or not.
I think that's great advice. Have you by any chance read Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma?
I have a book, but I haven't read it yet.
It's the whole premise is based around that, about locally sourced food, farmers market. It's actually one of my favorite books on nutrition, because it's a weird one, because he speaks at the very beginning that he's had vegetarians turn back to meat after it, and he's had carnivore people go, I'm never touching meat again after, because of the message that they got from it. But it basically comes back to the locally sourced food, farmers market, etc. For anyone listening, I highly recommend that book by Michael Pollan. This is going to be a perfect segue, because you mentioned gut health there. And we're going to get on to IBS and irritable bowel syndrome. But just to segue beforehand, talk to me about the importance of gut health, and just anything that you've seen, any studies of note, or just your own experience, because it's taken a lot of popularity now for good reason. I think it's rightly so, because a lot of the food with different ways that it's grown, etc., is all having a negative impact on lots of people's gut health. But talk to me about anything that you may have found worth note that you'd like to speak about on gut health, because I know you cover that a lot on your Instagram page as well.
Yeah, so I think gut health is so important for most people, because when your gut malfunctions, it won't, you know, you become miserable. So like, take IBS. It's very, like, so many people suffer from IBS, and they might suffer from a time period in their life and never have it again. But most people have had gut issues. And the thing about something like IBS is that it won't kill you, but it will make you miserable. And that's why it's so important. You see, nutrition isn't just about, you know, reducing our risk of horrible diseases that, you know, that kill us. It's about quality of life. And I think everyone's interest in gut health has come from that simple thing, that they just want to feel better. And every time you eat, if you're getting gut upset every time you eat, your relationship with food is affected, but also how good you feel on a day-to-day basis, on an hourly basis, is affected. When it comes to gut health, I think what people need to really realize, and maybe even learn for the first time, is that our gut is connected to every other place in our body. So if, for example, there were studies, for example, that they give probiotics, so good bacteria, to people, and it changed their gut bacteria and actually impacted their kidney health. And there was other studies, and lots of them, showing the interaction between our gut and our brain. So in mice, for instance, they took the bacteria out of one mouse and put it into another, the colon of another mouse, and it actually affected mood. So what you must realize when it comes to your gut health and the bacteria within your gut is that it's linked to every system in your body and every organ in your body. No one organ or system functions in solitude. It all functions together as one unit. And I think people are going to realize this more and more and get more and more interested in it. But simply, if your gut is healthy, it does improve every other inch of you.
Yeah, I think it's rightly called the second brain. The more knowledge we get on the gut. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I may be off with my percentages, but I think, is it 90 or 95% of our serotonin, our happy hormone, is produced in our gut? I know it's something ridiculous. You'd know better, because you're very, very schooled up on those studies. But I know it's a very high proportion of serotonin production is in the gut.
Yeah, so it's estimated at 80 to 90% of our serotonin. And that's why, so one of the things with IBS is that one of the things that a GP might do is give someone who's suffering from IBS, and especially diarrhea dominant IBS, and they give them a very low dose of an antidepressant. And the weird thing is that antidepressant is such a low dose that it's not going to have any impact on, or much, if any, impact on their brain. But because there's 9 times more serotonin in their gut, it has an impact there. And, you know, I suppose, even if we think about our language, you know, we talk about our gut feeling, and we feel a lot of emotions in our gut and in our stomach. And even when we're nervous, we get butterflies. And, you know, and even if we're stressed or nervous, like, do you ever, at the start of an adventure race or a triathlon or a running race or anything, so there's a mad big queue for the Portaloo. You know, you want to get in there early. But our gut is very much affected to our brain, and they both communicate, and both our brain communicates with our gut and our gut communicates with our brain. And it is rightly called the second brain. And it'll probably get to the stage where when we're considering our brain, we just automatically consider our gut as well.
Yeah, it's so funny you say that about the toilets at events, because it's a really common thing. It's I read in Robert Sapolsky's, he does a lot of endocrinology stuff at Stanford, his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, he spoke about why that happens. It's like the cortisol dump, where your body's trying to get rid of everything in it in case it's going to like run away from a tiger. Like, because I used to get it really bad until I realized that I'm like, everybody's doing this. What's going on? And I realized, it's just physiology.
It is. It's okay. And it's something that people who do these races a lot, like, all you just talk about it. It is a point of discussion before the race. Did you? Didn't you? Yeah, I did. I feel much better for it.
It's so true. I'm curious with IBS, because this is a topic I've covered a bit on the podcast, but not loads. Yeah. And as someone that I want to, well, I have IBS in the sense that it doesn't bother me at all anymore. It's managed, but I don't think you fully, unless you completely heal your gut over a longer period of time, I think you more manage it than actually get rid of it. I think if you're on that autoimmune spectrum, you're probably always going to be sensitive to certain foods, etc. Now, I've done lots of stuff myself to fix it. It doesn't flare up at all anymore. It doesn't bother me at all. But I'm curious, when you're working with people, again, I suppose similar to the weight loss, what kind of misconceptions or myths or problems do you regularly see with people when they come to you that have IBS? Because there's a lot of people listening that have, because I get IBS messages all the time, anytime I mention it on an Instagram story or anything along those lines, because there's so many people with autoimmune issues, you know, such as irritable bowel. Is there certain problems or certain trends that you see with people when they're coming to you with IBS, diet related, stress related, etc.? What kind of approach do you take when someone comes to you first?
Well, one thing is that when it comes to IBS,
can you just explain, actually, sorry, just before we go on, just very, very brief, just for anyone that's not familiar with IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, you know, just small intestine spasms, etc. Can you just give us a quick rundown on that? And then just for anybody that's unfamiliar.
So IBS is irritable bowel syndrome. And like I said before, it won't kill you, but it'll probably make you miserable. It does affect your quality of life. It usually involves pain or discomfort. And you get associated symptoms. So some people might have constipation and other people might have more diarrhea, and you get kind of bloating, distension, flatulence. And, you know, the upper gut is important too. So, you know, people often talk about their lower gut issues, but, you know, you could get things like reflux, so heartburn and indigestion. You could get early satiety, which is feeling full really quickly, and certain things like even bad breath. But mainly the symptoms are, it's usually kind of the pain or discomfort, and usually diarrhea, constipation, bloating or pain. But the thing about IBS is that people tend to suffer in silence and suffer for a long time and don't seek help soon enough. And the issue is that it's become their normal. So they actually think it's normal to have these gut issues, and it's normal that they have to watch their gut function and be hyper vigilant with it, or else they'll suffer from it. But that's not the case, you know. So, for example, if you have IBS and you're diarrhea dominant or bloating or gas, there is there's lots of different things that you can do. But for example, one area that you can try, but you need guidance from a dietitian to do it, is what's called the low FODMAP diet. So you take out fermentable carbohydrates from the diet for 4 weeks, usually 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes 4 to 8 weeks, depending on how bad someone is. Usually people get symptom relief nearly straight away. So within a few days, it feels like magic to the people who have been suffering for that long.
What would be an example of did you say fermentable drinks?
So fermentable carbohydrates would be, they can be some of the starches, just wheat, barley and rye. Yeah. They can be fruit and veg. So the likes of apples and pears, or onions and garlic, or beans, peas and lentils, cauliflower, asparagus, mushrooms. So there's lots of different fruits or vegetables and starches in that bracket. And what you do with the low FODMAP diet is you just take them all them out of the diet for around 4 weeks, and then you reintroduce them, and you reintroduce them in a very specific way. Find out what FODMAP people that person is intolerant to, but more importantly, how find their threshold point. So find how much you can have before you're symptomatic. So for example, someone lactose intolerance is one of them, and that's one of the fermentable carbohydrates. And you know, often when people are lactose intolerant, they think they can't have any, but usually there's a threshold point and they can have maybe 15 grams of lactose. And when they go over that, they have symptoms. And the thing is, once you know how much you can tolerate, what you can do is you can either avoid certain portions of milk or yogurt or dairy, or you can eat them and know you're going to get symptoms, but feel that it's worth it at that time. Or what you can do is when you go above your threshold, you can take lactase enzymes, and that can mean that you can have that food, but you don't have the nasty side effects from it. So when you do the likes of a low FODMAP diet, which is an elimination and reintroduction diet, you find out how to manage your IBS for the rest of your life. The thing is that's worth noting when it comes to IBS is that it's cyclical. So you can go in cycles of it where you're fine and then it stops and goes away again, and then it can rear its ugly head again. The other thing is in that life cycles, your gut function can change. So for example, even myself, I couldn't have onions nearly at all until I got pregnant. And then all of a sudden now, while pregnant, I can tolerate them. So, you know, it does, you know, our hormones do change, and as we get older, we change, and intolerances and thresholds can change. But the low FODMAP diet, it's successful in more than 3 out of 4 people in providing complete symptom relief. So that's phenomenal results. And it really, for something that's so, so common, people don't need to be walking around miserable with their IBS. It's a really solvable issue.
You said something there about the gut health changing, you know, in the life cycle as you get older, etc.
Yeah.
And again, you may not know the answer to this, but I'm just curious, do you know why that is? Is that a endocrinology, you know, a hormone changing as people get older, and as a result the gut changes as well? Or do you know why that is? Because that makes perfect sense, but I'm unfamiliar with any research on it myself.
So it's multifactorial. So like every answer, I feel like such a dietitian go, well, it's multifactorial, but it is. So it can be hormonal. Like I said, you know, got pregnant and I can have onions. It can be to do with the enzyme count in our intestines. So for example, people can get more lactose intolerant as they age. It can also be to do with certain elements of stress and your ability to manage stress. So as you get older, your tools for managing stress usually become better. And I suppose life becomes less dramatic as well. Well, hopefully for most people. And, you know, so stress does have a huge impact in our gut. I think with IBS, people often come in and go, I'm not stressed, but my gut is. And they're probably sick of people going, oh, you've IBS, it must be stress. But it's also stressful to have IBS. So it's a chicken and egg sort of situation. But regardless of who you are, stress or anxiety will impact your gut. And if you have IBS, it will exacerbate that. So I think as people get older, hopefully their stress levels reduce, maybe because the stressful events in their life have reduced, or maybe because they've got better at dealing with their stress or managing it. And that will have an impact on their gut function as they get older too.
Yeah, what you mentioned there about IBS, again, I resonated so much with it, that it becomes your norm when you're, I remember in my, you know, early 20s, I was like, oh, you just kind of get on with it and realize that, right, if I go out with, you know, to this dinner with a group of friends, I'm not going to feel good. And you just kind of avoid it for whatever reason. Like, a lot of social issues come with IBS because of that, you know, because of the amount of cultural stuff we have around food, etc. With the diet protocol you mentioned there, which is a really good way to start. Do you put in any supplements with that? Gut healing supplements, probiotics, anything along those lines with it? Or do you just go managing lifestyle and food first and then come back to supplements later, or do you, if even at all?
Well, sometimes I don't use the low FODMAP approach, so I don't use it in all people when I feel like there's something other obvious that's that we can pinpoint. And it's also, it's not necessarily the first approach I would take with IBS, constipation dominant. But when you're following the elimination diet, you don't want to be doing other things at the same time, because you need to be able to go with certainty that's causing you issues and that's not. The problem is when you change a lot of things at once, you sometimes don't know then what did I get benefit from. So if you just say follow the low FODMAP diet and you're taking a probiotic and your gut gets better, is it the low FODMAP diet or is it the probiotic? And if it's both of them, how much is one affecting versus the other? So when it comes to dietary impacts, when it comes to supplements and things like that, I either might use them before or I might use them after, usually after. But I try to do one thing at a time so people know with certainty what's working for them and what's not. One thing that's interesting with the IBS, though, and, you know, hopefully a lot of your listeners don't know too much about it, but as you get older, people tend to be more and more prone to having to take laxatives, that they're more constipation prone. And one thing that's interesting, and you probably have read a lot about it yourself at this point, is just muscle loss with aging. And I think what's really interesting is often we talk about muscle loss or muscle gains on social media, and we forget that the bulk of our muscles are actually internal. We forget that the bulk of our muscles are heart or diaphragm or gut. And if you lose muscle tissue, you're going to lose some of these important internal tissues too. So muscle loss with aging does mean that someone's heart gets weaker, their diaphragm gets weaker, and their gut gets weaker. And that does contribute to whether or not they're at risk of constipation. So I think even if we look at younger people, when, for example, they're not getting enough protein at each of their meals or not doing any sort of strength exercise, they do risk losing that important gut, important internal issues, as well as the internal muscles as well as the muscles in their arms and their legs and things. So that's just something, another piece I would like to bring in, that, you know, when your diet isn't balanced and when you're not exercising, you do run the risk of developing IBS or your IBS getting worse and worse.
Yeah, and I found myself that probably one of the again, I kind of look at the way that I've, I won't say cured, but completely managed my IBS would be a pretty accurate term. One is down to training, because of the anti-anxiety and the de-stress from training.
Yeah.
And sleep. Like, there, sleep is the one, Orla, that I think I had an IBS trigger probably about a year ago, and it was after about a week of not sleeping. Holly was, my daughter was sick. She was only two at the time.
Yeah.
And my IBS flared up like crazy. So it, we think sometimes IBS, we think, oh, stress, we think, oh, certain foods, but there's other things like skipping training or not sleeping that can all have a huge impact. From personal experience, that's anecdotal massively, but I'm aware that the, you know, cortisol is going to be elevated after not sleeping. Also, food choices tend to be worse if you haven't slept, in my case anyway. What are your thoughts on gluten? Just because anytime I ever read anything on IBS or autoimmune, anyone on the autoimmune spectrum, full stop, PCOS, etc., gluten is always the one that gets demonized massively. And I'm, again, on the, you know, you don't like being on the fence. I'm on the fence with it because I can argue pros and cons both sides to it. What are your thoughts on gluten for people with on the autoimmune spectrum?
So gluten on the autoimmune spectrum, there's different things. So for example, if some people with thyroid issues, when they have an autoimmune disease that is affecting their thyroid and they go on a gluten-free diet, it actually can really improve their thyroid function. And the other thing is, it's worth noting that thyroid issues are very common in Ireland. And on the gene for those sorts of autoimmune thyroid issues falls celiac disease and type 1 diabetes. So, you know, for example, if someone has type 1 diabetes, they need to be checked regularly checking their bloods regularly with their GP to make sure that their thyroid function's okay and that they're not a celiac, because they're more prone to having thyroid issues and celiac disease if they're type 1. And all of these things are interconnected. So I think gluten is something that is, there's research emerging all the time. I think one of the biggest things, though, I'd like to point out is that gluten is found in wheat, barley and rye. Now, going back to what I was saying about the fermentable carbohydrates, those FODMAPs, they're found in wheat, barley and rye. So often when people cut out gluten, they go, oh, my stomach is much better, my IBS is much better. But is it because they cut out gluten, or is it because they've cut out foods that contain gluten but also contain these fermentable carbohydrates? So generally speaking, how you know if you fall into one rather than the other is that people who have IBS who cut out gluten feel better, but they're not completely better. And that's because the fermentable carbohydrates that are found in wheat, barley and rye are also found in certain vegetables like onions and garlic. So people can wrongly pinpoint it. And that's really common because it's very easy to do. You cut out gluten, you cut out wheat, barley and rye, you feel better. You presume it's the gluten. But actually, you've cut out fermentable carbohydrates, and that's why you feel better. So sometimes people wrongly blame gluten. That said, there is research coming out, and it's only in the last month or two, that has shown that a gluten-free diet improved bloating in people with IBS. And also there's a little bit of research, not, I wouldn't say it's great research, and they certainly haven't used enough people, but gluten-free diet can sometimes help with people who have endometriosis in terms of pain. So when it comes to a gluten-free diet, sometimes it's worth trialing, and sometimes there's no research to suggest that we should try it. But I wouldn't do it willy-nilly. I wouldn't do it without a bit of evidence to suggest, you know, it might do you some good, and it definitely won't do you some harm, so it's worth a go.
Yeah, well, definitely, I think anybody on the autoimmune spectrum, a lot of dietary stuff, and again, I think this is the same for muscle building and weight loss, try it and see, you know, experiment with it. Like, really, you don't know until you try. I can only ever offer opinions on, you know, keto or vegan and diets that I've tried and explained. I'm like, oh, I've done vegan for, you know, a month at most, and I'm like, I felt weak, like, for me, because I'd been eating a lot of fish and meat, and obviously had way more complete amino acids. So I'm like, maybe going 80% plant-based with some meat and fish is probably the best way for me. But for somebody else,
that's interesting. So you guinea pig on yourself. I always have guinea pigs on myself as well. So a lot of nutritionists, dietitians and other people I've met in the fitness industry, they don't try the things that they encourage other people to try. Now, I've tried nearly most diets out there, because even if it's a fad diet, Brian, even the worst faddy diets have some pros. Like, they have more cons than pros. But I want to find what are the pros of each and every diet out there. Because if we were to accumulate all the pros from all these faddy diets and put them together, what we have is one ultimate diet that has many more pros than cons. So I have done most things. I haven't done a vegan diet, I have to admit. I keep on egging myself and going, no, I can do this. And I chicken out at the last minute. But one thing that I could try, because with weight loss surgery, people have to go on liquid diets for a week beforehand. So it's usually nutritionally complete diets, or else they do 3 to 4 days on milk only. And I did try it, and I was supposed to do it for a week, and I lasted 3.66 days.
So, Jesus.
Do you know what I broke it with? And this is so embarrassing. But I broke it with broccoli. I know. But I missed chewing. I missed the crunch. And I just actually, I obviously didn't feel well. Like, not going to be a diet. No, the diet really for weight loss surgery is just reduce liver size, so that surgery is a bit safer. But it wasn't obviously a good diet to be following. But I broke with broccoli because I just missed crunch. I missed chewing. But vegan diet, I haven't done it yet, but I've done nearly every other diet under the sun. Just like I said, to understand the pros and try and understand what the cons are. And then if you know what the cons are, you know how to get across them. You know how to improve these things.
And it's funny because some of the cons, again, I'm only speaking from my own personal experience, but when you've experienced the cons yourself, you're able to give just a better explanation to maybe this isn't the best approach. You don't, you know, not everyone needs to be a guinea pig. I love that you yeah. do it as well. But, you know, it's a case. And the truth is, certain other cons can work out really, really well. Like I was trying the keto diet way before it became popular to try and improve yeah. endurance. Then when people were like, oh yeah, this is amazing, I started seeing it pop up in magazines and things for weight loss. And I'm like, that's a terrible fucking diet to do for weight loss. I was like, you gotta cut all your carbs and drop your protein really low. I'm like, it's really hard to stick to if you're doing, you know, runs through the desert and ultra marathons. I was like, don't mind to just drop a couple of dress sizes. It's really hard.
Oh, but that's the thing, Brian. But like, you understand that it's actually what a keto diet is. But if you go on social media, you think keto diet just means low carb. And it actually means 80% fat, 10% protein, 10% carbs. So it's low carbohydrate and low protein and super high in fat. And the problem is that on social media, it's nearly... people don't really understand, I feel, what a ketogenic diet is. So they're doing it and they're doing it all wrong. But the ketogenic diet does have some serious cons to it. Like, you know, when people follow it, they do smell, don't they?
Yeah.
Their breath is just appalling.
And your skin, your sweat is weird as well. It's a weird one.
Oh, yeah, no, it definitely, you know, and so it's worth kind of the practitioner guinea pigging all of these things, because like you said, when you understand the cons, you can actually tailor the diet so that the cons disappear, or you can find ways around the cons. But, you know, I think even with fad diets, that's why I don't always dismiss them completely, because there are some pros and it's worth knowing what those pros are. But then there's some diets that are just plain crap. They're just plain bad for you. And the juice diet has to be my favorite bad diet. Like, there's just like no pros to that. There's only cons.
Well, there's no sustainability with it. Like, the thing is, I had this conversation recently. I don't know, was it on the podcast or just with friends, that the thing is with juice diets, and I've said this on the podcast, is they work for weight loss. You stop eating food, you will lose weight. I'm like, if that didn't work, they'd have been gone long ago, because people wouldn't do them. So it's just that it doesn't stay off. A lot of it's water. Some of it's muscle glycogen. You know, there's a little bit of it's body fat, I'm sure, if you do it for 6 weeks. But it's just the sustainability and the negative effect out the other side on you know, ghrelin, leptin, hunger, satiation hormones, all these other negative rebounds that come from it. And not to mention the psychological of like dropping down a certain dress size or losing body fat as a guy and then rebounding back. Like, that's way worse psychologically than not losing the weight at all.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think people need to really, when they're trying something, when they're trying to get healthier, they need to, the sustainable approach is not only better for your physical self, it's better for your mental health. Because like you said, the psychological impact of that weight rebounding up again, or even not even just regaining what you've lost, but regaining what you've lost and then some, that has a big impact on someone's psychological, like mental health, and their, you know, their motivation, and also, you know, their feeling of self-worth, self-esteem, you know, achievement is going to be affected. So that's why the sustainable approach is, it's nearly always best. But like you said, with a lot of these fad diets, when you're not getting enough calories in, or when you're not getting enough of protein in at each of your meals, it can affect your body composition. So what's the point in losing 3 stone if you just become a lighter version of yourself? What people are after is becoming a leaner version of themselves. And to become a leaner version of yourself, you have to preserve your muscle mass during weight loss. And again, to hit home with it, 60%, so more than half of your muscle is internal. It's your heart, your diaphragm, your gut, internal stuff. You don't want to be losing that, because that's not going to be good for your health in the long term. So, you know, when it comes to these fad diets, although we might try them in guinea pig and joke about it, the fact is that if they're too extreme in terms of too many calories are cut, and if they're too extreme in that, for example, you're not getting adequate protein with your mealtimes, you are going to have some serious consequences because of that. But one thing that you mentioned there about following the vegan diet for a month is that I don't think people realize that there's certain nutrients that just can't be obtained from a vegan diet. So therefore, a vegan diet isn't actually nutritionally complete. And it is so important when following a vegan diet that you make sure that you're getting adequate protein at your breakfast, lunch and dinner. And that's why even on Instagram, I was like, okay, I'm gonna put up plant protein sources and tell people exactly how much is in that source so that they can at least try and get adequate protein at breakfast, lunch and dinner. But one thing is that you oily fish is the only source of that EPA and DHA omega-3 fatty acid. You can't get that from plants. The omega-3 in walnuts and chia seeds and stuff like that and flax, that's not the same thing. So if someone is going on a vegan diet, they have to be careful about these essential nutrients. So omega-3 is something that is essential to the body, meaning our body, it's essential to life, but our body can't make it. It relies on us giving it or eating it or consuming it and giving it to the body. So if people are following a vegan diet and they're not supplementing omega-3, they will have consequences of that. So, you know, when it comes to more extreme diets, I'm not saying the vegan diet is a fatty diet, but it is an extreme diet. You do need to take supplements when and where they're needed.
Yeah, I completely agree. I trebled up my omega-3 for a month. It was just under a month, but 3.5 weeks. And also vitamin B12, because that was one that I really struggled. If you're not getting it from meat, I was really struggling to get vitamin B12 from food. So that's another one that's worth considering supplementing from my experience. I know it's stored long term, but it's one that doesn't show up. But a deficiency in B12 tends to have a lot of problems that don't tend to show up for several years. But just as if you're vegan listening to this, it's just worth a quick Google search on vitamin B12 and vegan diet, just to kind of school yourself on that alongside omega-3 and a vegan diet for anybody listening.
Yeah, and perhaps vitamin D and iodine as well, because iodine is something that you get, we get, like Irish people get 50% of their iodine from dairy. So you know, you can get iodine from seaweed, but how many Irish people eat seaweed? So, you know, in the Irish diet, we rely heavily on dairy for our iodine and fish. And obviously on the vegan diet, you're not eating dairy or fish. So again, iodine is something to look in on. And not all the milk alternatives have actually been fortified with iodine. So even if you're thinking, oh, you know, but I'm having almond milk, make sure it's a brand that actually has iodine added as well as B12 and vitamin D.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's when I was over in California, seaweed's a big thing over there at the minute. They're always a couple of years ahead of us in the sense, in parts of California, like that's not everywhere, but like in Northern Cal, or even like Berkeley, that side is very health conscious, and seaweed is like an option in a lot of the mainstream health restaurants. But that's obviously why, because it's this natural source.
I know,
of
but they might be steps ahead of us, but sure, they're only copying the Japanese. You know, the Japanese diet is one hell of a good diet. I did a research for Board BA years ago, and one thing we did was analyzed the nutritional food diaries from different countries, and 1,000 food diaries I analyzed from Japan, and the iodine intakes were unbelievably, they were 10 times higher than the Irish iodine intakes. And, you know, it was very, very, very interesting. And even despite the Japanese diet being high in salt, because they ate so much veg, which is high in potassium, they didn't have the same blood pressure issues. And they ate 3 balanced meals every single, like, you know, breakfast was balanced, lunch was balanced, dinner was balanced. They had a protein at each meal. They had lots of veg at each meal. And they had a carbohydrate source at each meal. And it's a wonder they live into 100. And you know, Irish people do live to 100, but the quality of life is really important. There's no point in living long if you don't live well.
Yeah, because Japan, it's funny you say that, because I don't know what I was looking at recently, but they were talking about the blue zones. Is it blue zones, the people that live to 100? Was Japan top of that or near top of that?
It is. So there's especially one of the islands, but there's a couple of around the world and in kind of southern Italy as well. And they're researching all the different blue zones and trying to figure out, you know, what is the specialty there? What is the secret ingredient? Mm-hmm. And one of them, I think what we Most nutritionists and dietitians, what we forget to focus in on is things like herbs and spices. And one of them in one of the countries has noted just how much rosemary in kind of in southern Italy, how much rosemary they eat and add to foods. And that's extremely high in antioxidants. And they're kind of going, is that one of the reasons why they live so long? Like, obviously, there'll be other reasons too. They're extremely active. But, you know, it's trying to find out the secret ingredients to all to the diets of those in the blue zones and trying to emulate them where we are. But I wouldn't underestimate the power of herbs and spices. And one of the things I always get people to do is just put a herb or spice into every single meal that they're eating.
Do you have any preferences?
No, because they're all good. So it just means, like, it sounds more complicated than it is. So it just means, like, when you're having eggs, maybe put chai. When you're having mushrooms, put nutmeg. When you're having tomatoes, basil. When you're having roast potatoes, thyme and rosemary. You know, so it's always kind of adding spices to things, and they're delicious. Like, you know, porridge is made better when you add ginger or cinnamon or mixed spice. So it's just kind of familiarizing yourself to all of these things. And, you know, they're dead cheap and you can get the dried versions easy enough. And in Irish climates, you can grow a lot of the herbs and spices. So I have most of them growing in the back garden. And, like, I wouldn't have peas without putting mint into it. So I'm just, I suppose I have my herbs and spices that I always put into certain fruits and vegetables or foods. And, you know, it's just about getting into the habit of it, because what we consistently do will affect what our body will always reflect what we consistently do.
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely love that. I'm totally stealing that and putting that in the title somewhere. One last topic I wanted to kind of cover on, because we've talked a lot of nutrition, diet, you know, the blue zones, even in Japan. But you put up a post on Instagram recently about low calorie alcohol. I loved your tip about how to look like you're drinking gin and tonic, so I'll let you tell that as well. But yeah. What are your thoughts on alcohol in general for weight loss, for health? What are your kind of thoughts on that? Where do you stand on it?
Listen, alcohol is probably the most damaging drug out there. And it's A&E. If you work in A&E, and if there's nurses and doctors listening, they're just like, if anything, they would nearly make alcohol illegal. It's not good for us, is basically what I'm saying. It's a toxin, it's a drug, and the health implications of alcohol versus nearly every other drug out there, it's much greater. Like, it's really bad for us. But we all know that. We, you know, a lot of Irish people still drink. So I think when it comes to alcohol and calories, that we need to be aware of how many calories that are in each of the alcoholic drinks. But we also need to be aware of the knock-on effects, because when people drink alcohol, they all often nibble on more food, and they might even stop in the chipper on the way home. And the next day they might go out for a brunch and get a less healthy choice. And will they go to the exercise class or go for a hike on the Sunday? Probably not. So it's a knock-on effect of alcohol, but it is important to know how many calories are in each drink. But one thing I'd say to people is to actually kind of go without even looking up the calories in each of the drink, and even think from themselves, if I was to stick on beer all night long, how many pints would I have? And if I was to stick to glasses of wine all night long, how many glasses would I have? And if I was to stick to just say gin and tonics, and break it down like that. And then once you've said, okay, what, how many pints or how many glasses would I naturally have, then tot up the calories. And whatever comes back at the lowest calorie per night is probably going to be the healthier choice for you. Because, for example, people go, oh, gin and tonic or vodka and Diet Coke, that's one of the lowest calorie drinks you can go for. But they drink twice as much of that. So it works out as the exact same. So I think what people need to do is they just need to tot up their standard night if they stuck to one drink. But, you know, when it comes to reducing your alcohol on a night out, it's definitely worth it. It's worth it health-wise and worth it for quality of life even the next day. And one simple tip I have for people is to make the second drink a glass of water. Make the second drink a coffee and make the fourth drink a glass of water. So usually, you know, when people go on a night out, they want to be energized. They want to have a good time. And the coffee, caffeine does that for you. It will give you energy and make sure that you have a better time. Then when it comes to the water, that being the fourth drink will actually have a huge impact on how well you feel the next day and therefore quality of the life the next day. So what you get up to on your Sunday rather than wasting it on the couch. So I'd encourage that. And for anyone who wants to pretend they're drinking. So sometimes I think in Ireland, it's a sad place that, you know, when you're not drinking, everyone presumes you're pregnant.
Or yeah. Or antibiotics. Antibiotics are pregnant are the two generally, isn't it?
It's a big thing. And loads of people out there just want to drink less. And it's the social stuff that they have to put up with, you know, and people's social reaction. But one, I have a couple of ways to pretend that you're drinking when you're not. The non-alcoholic beers are amazing because firstly, they do taste pretty good. And, you know, I've done taste tests in my house and people haven't been able to taste the difference between the non-alcoholic beers and the alcoholic beers. You can taste the difference between the ciders. But one thing is if you are a fan of the gin and tonic, what I usually do is I get the tonic poured into my glass. And I get it dressed up exactly like a gin and tonic is supposed to look. And because it's a clear liquid, no one knows that you're not drinking. Now, I use this when trying to hide the fact that I was pregnant for as long as possible. But I'd go up to the bar staff and I'd ask them, you know, make this tonic look as gin and tonic as you possibly can. And they were absolutely great putting in the juniper berries or grapefruit or what have you and just making my gin and tonic look as gin and tonically as possible, even though it was just tonic. But I would encourage people to reassess their alcohol intake. And I think that people are doing that. I don't think people have the same attitude that they once had with alcohol. And I think with the help of social media isn't all bad. I think with the help of social media, I think people are realizing the health consequences of alcohol. You know, even from a guy's point of view, the impact it has on your ability to gain muscle or the impact it has on your testosterone, like they are worth considering if you're a young guy trying to be as fit as possible or a young guy worried that that their testosterone might be as good as they want it to be. And I think women are aware that, you know, it will, and men, that it will have an impact on things like fertility. So I think people are realizing the health implications of alcohol. And I think people are aware of and being more mindful of the social impact, because, you know, if you get too drunk, you're a misery for your friends because they have to deal with you. You usually do something that you regret. And, you know, and I think people are being more mindful when it comes to alcohol. I really do. I do believe that. Whether I'm right or wrong, I don't know. But I think people are more mindful of the health implications of alcohol.
No, I think you're right. I think we've taken leaps forward in the last even 5 years, 6 years on people being able to go out and not drink and not be questioned or kind of ostracized for it. You mentioned there about testosterone for guys. It's funny, in my most recent book, my GA book, I have a section in there. And as I was scrolling through the studies on testosterone and alcohol for guys, it's very eye-opening. How,
isn't it?
On fertility, on actual levels, it's quite an eye-opener, because it's not something, again, I'll speak for myself only, but in my early 20s, it's not something I would have associated that alcohol would have such a negative impact on my testosterone.
Yeah, and testosterone has such an impact on your body fat levels and your muscle mass. Sure, it's why us girls go to the gym and try and get stronger and stronger. And you know, it's so much slower for women than men. And it's because of testosterone. And it's why guys can lose fat faster is because of testosterone. Like, it's a wonderful hormone to have lots of. And the fact that your testosterone will be affected by how much you drink, I think people didn't know about that. And because of the likes of yourself, I think people are becoming more mindful of it and aware of at least and the associations. And I think other things like alcohol and cancer and, you know, so each drink you have extra each day is going to have alcoholic drink is going to increase your risk of breast cancer by 8%. I think people are now associating excess alcohol intake with the likes of breast cancer. So I think people are becoming more aware. And I suppose in Ireland, we have to be aware that we have a lot of people who have a high dependency on alcohol, so alcoholics. And what we need to do is get rid of the social stigma when it comes to alcohol, because people might be giving it up because they're addicted to it. People might be giving it up because it affects their serotonin and how happy they feel the next day or that night. And I think, you know, with a lot of Irish people suffering with mental health issues, that we should be more mindful about how we perceive drinking and alcohol in Ireland because of the huge impact it has on mental health. So I think hopefully the taboo around not drinking alcohol on a night out is lessening, and people are biting their tongue a little bit more, not just assuming people are dry shites if they're not drinking or pregnant.
Yeah, no, I think it's, and I'm glad to see it moving in that direction. And it's not even and for anyone listening, I think I'm right in speaking for Orla as well. We're not saying don't drink any alcohol. It's more just clue yourself in what's happening, the health implications, the effect it will have on your progress, fat loss, muscle building, etc. And then make your decision based out of that. Like it's a knowledge thing and an educational thing. And this one of the reasons I love the stuff you put out, Orla. It's evidence-based, it's science-backed, and also very accessible because you're able to word it in ways that makes it understandable for people. So I can't thank you enough for this, Orla. We'll have to do it again soon because this is freaking awesome. Tell everybody listening, where's the best place to find out more about you, if they want to work with you, if they want to follow you on social media, where's the best place to reach out and connect?
Well, I'm Orla Walsh Nutrition on Instagram and Facebook. My website is Orla Walsh Nutrition as well. And then Twitter, because you weren't allowed as many letters, I'm just Orla C. Walsh.
Deadly. And I'm everybody listening, I'll be linking all of those in the show notes on briankeenfitness.com. I'll tag Orla across on all my platforms as well. So go give her a follow, check out her stuff. Preaching from the same hymn sheet, Orla. Thank you so much again for this.
Thanks a million.